This is the Wisdom Podcast.
By the time we're aware or mindful of anything, it's already been filtered and sometimes exaggerated to fit what we want to see. Our perception is not raw data. It's already been bent, twisted, even denied, if it challenges us far too deeply.
Welcome to the Wisdom Podcast. I'm Daniel Aiken, and for this episode I traveled to Berkeley, California to speak with Venerable Ajahn Brahm, meditation teacher in the Thai forest tradition and author of many popular books including Falling is Flying, The Art of Disappearing, and Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. In this conversation, I asked Ajahn Brahm about his early interest in theoretical physics at Cambridge University and how this intersected with his interest in Buddhist thought. He talks about the constructed nature of perception and how what we perceive is largely contained within the limits of our own imagination. He also discusses what he calls the art of disappearing, namely the relationship between letting go, stillness, and vanishing. He explains how true mindfulness emerges from this place of disappearance and discusses this in the context of higher states of meditation. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Oh, about 300, 400 years ago, people thought this was a flat earth. That if you went far enough, you will fall off the edge of the earth.
That's right.
But we now know that this earth is round. It's got a limited area, but it's got no beginning, no end. It's got no edges to it. And the same way if you go into space, the universe, that too is limited volume. But it's got no boundaries to it.
You see the back
There's
of
no
head.
Edge. Yeah. So, let's go to the next level. Time. We all believe in flat time at the moment.
Yeah.
A beginning and an end. What if time, like planet Earth, like space, was curved? So there was no beginning, no creation, no origin, but a curve. Like there's no edge of time. A time without boundaries. And because you know that one of my best friends, the first Buddhist I ever met, was a very close disciple of Professor Stephen Hawking. And he was featured in the bio picture of Professor Hawking. And there I heard this from my friend, Professor Bernard Carr. And I heard it for myself that Professor Stephen Hawking, before he passed away, he understood a universe without boundaries, no beginning, no end, no edge, no creation, no finishing. A universe like planet Earth, no beginning, no end, no center, just a sphere, curved in time.
So this is, can you relate this to any sutras?
Yeah, well, just beginningless.
Beginningless time.
And the whole of universe being like a samsara, being like a wheel. So a wheel doesn't have a start, doesn't have an end. It goes round and round and round.
Yeah.
Without beginning, without end.
What does cessation mean in this space?
Cessation means you get off the wheel.
You get off the wheel.
The wheel just keeps on rolling.
Yeah.
But you're no longer on it.
So time is beginningless, endless. But there's also a space that's timeless, and that's cessation.
Not a space, yeah, cessation.
Yeah,
not
cessation
a space.
Cessation is timeless.
Yeah, all space is round.
All space is round. All time is round.
Round, yes. But you can disappear.
Yeah. So round, we can use that word for space.
Yes.
Or would we use the word for time? Because
for round, time round as well, yes.
We can say time is round as
yes.
well.
Yes. But then you can actually say that these consciousnesses, they can just disappear.
Yeah.
They can vanish, so they're no longer here.
Yeah, this is cessation.
Cessation, yes.
So consciousness doesn't really have a beginning.
No.
But it has an end, and that's end
it,
is cessation.
It has an end. Well, calling it an end is the wrong word.
Okay.
It has a vanishing.
It has a vanishing, a disappearing.
A disappearing.
Yeah.
The great art of getting lost.
Getting lost in the timeless.
In timeless, yes. So you're not there anymore.
Yeah. So as soon as you have time.
Yes, as soon as you have time. Actually, we don't have much time.
We don't have much time.
We're always looking for more time. And that's why, because when there's a we and I, There's never enough time.
Yeah.
But when you disappear, for example, you have the two words which we're supposed to develop in our practice of being here and being now.
Yeah.
And how can you actually perfect that being here and being now? Put them the other way around. Be now, be here.
Yeah.
Now plus here. What does that spell?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Nowhere, yes. So disappearing, ceasing means you're nowhere.
Yeah. Now plus here.
Yes.
Nowhere. Disappearing, cessation.
Yes, yes.
So you were interested in theoretical physics back in the day.
Yes.
Went to study that at the University of Cambridge.
Yeah.
What inspired that search in physics?
That search, it was just because you were fascinated, you know, with the meaning of life. And at that time, I only thought life was the physical world. Just bodies, just planets, just stuff. And so you wanted to try and find some meaning and some truth, you know, through the study of stuff. But then you found as many other people were also studying stuff. And they found that there was spaces and gaps in stuff. Well, they used to say the ghost in the machine, that there was a mind there, there was a consciousness, there was something happening without which, you know, the universe would not exist. And that was a fascinating thing to actually to try and investigate. So just mentioning that first Buddhist who I ever met was Professor Bernard Carr, but he was just a student like me. And we both were into theoretical physics. We were both Buddhists, and we both joined the Psychic Research Society. We went to hunt ghosts and also do some very interesting experiments just on perception.
Mm.
And one of the experiments he told me about a couple of years ago was what he called the flowerpot experiment. This was performed in Imperial College in London, which was part of London University and had a lot of great scientists would study there and produce papers there. And one of his friends claimed that he could demonstrate in the laboratory levitation. So he managed to get a lot of professors and scientists, trained observers, to come into one of the lecture theatres in Imperial College in London to see levitation in action.
Mm.
And so he came in with this flower pot and he placed it on the table, and all the physicists and scientists could witness this. They had cameras rolling, infrared cameras, UV cameras, just to make sure that everybody could see what would happen if he could levitate this flower pot. And he asked his audience of old professors and very well published scientists to help out creating the right atmosphere by all chanting Om together. And I say that his great achievement was actually to convince all his old professors to go chanting Om. And as they were chanting Om, the flower pot rose into the air.
Mm-hmm.
It worked. They filmed it, they photographed it, and afterwards, they asked many of the professors and the scientists who were supposed to be trained observers what they saw.
Mm.
And a couple of those observers were supposed to be objective observers.
Mm.
Said the flower pot stayed on the table throughout. It never moved.
Yeah.
And they said, well, here's the photograph, here's the video. Said, no, that was fake. It stayed on the table all the time. And that was the whole purpose of the experiment, to show that if it's something we think is impossible, it cannot happen. Even if it does, we block it from our perception. We're not even conscious of actually seeing it. Because the truth of the matter was that underneath that bench, There was a huge electromagnet. And they, yes, that's why it levitated. But they needed to get all the professors to chant Om. Because whenever you turn on such a very big current, you can always hear the hum of the current. So chanting Om served the purpose of disguising what was really going on, masking the sound of the very heavy current. But the purpose was, even though it did levitate, people would not see it.
The limits of our imagination can limit our perception.
Yes, indeed. It's our views.
Mm.
And if it's something that's too impossible to see, we won't even be conscious that we're blocking it from our perception.
Mm.
It's not as if we observe and say it must be wrong. We don't even observe it.
No.
And so this was a purpose to show just how much of our world we block out because it's too challenging for us to contemplate. We just don't see it. So there's no such thing as bare awareness. By the time we're aware or mindful of anything, it's already been filtered and sometimes exaggerated to fit what we want to see.
So perception is a form of construction, would you agree?
Indeed.
With that?
Our perception is not raw data. Mm-hmm. It's already been bent, twisted, even denied if it challenges us far too deeply.
Are you skeptical of there being raw data at all?
No, there can be raw data.
Yeah.
But the only way to know this raw data is to have such a mind which does not bend the truth.
Yeah.
I was saying to someone earlier, there's two types of religion in our world.
Mm.
One which bends the truth to fit their faith.
Mm.
The other one bends the faith to fit the truth.
Yeah.
And to be able to have that second one, bending the faith to fit the truth, is very difficult. You have to have a very strong mind which suspends what you want to see, what you don't want to see. Basically, what they say in Buddhism is actually to suppress the five hindrances, which bend the truth to fit what you want to see and filter out what you find too difficult to actually accept.
So it's the five hindrances that are bending.
The truth, yes.
The truth. Okay.
They are the cause, the nutriments of delusion.
So these scientists who had their truth bended, what do you think was the hindrance? Was it aversion?
It's just too difficult to actually to go back to basics and to understand that such a thing like levitation could exist.
Mm.
Or these days, to actually to think that such a concept like rebirth or reincarnation can exist. Mm-hmm. To me it's very evident, very obvious, but many Buddhists, they come to me in a Western world who've been highly educated and say that's one thing about Buddhism they cannot accept, reincarnation. I ask them why. Mm. They say it's because there's no evidence.
Yeah.
So what do you mean there's no evidence?
Mm.
Have a look through all the amazing research which has been done on that subject from many different angles over many, many decades. The evidence is there.
Mm.
Have you read it? And of course, they say no. Because it doesn't exist.
They don't see the evidence.
They don't see the evidence because like it doesn't exist. Because it doesn't exist, they don't even look for the evidence.
Yeah. So what was it on the topic of rebirth, what was it that bended your faith towards that truth?
It was something which I accepted when I was even just a student.
Mm.
I thought it's so obvious that, why can life suddenly appear from nowhere? And why are these great savants, people who, when they're born, after just a little while, they could, like Mozart was one of the great ones who could just do so much. And why have people got these abilities which they were never taught? And of course, later on, when you started to see evidence of this accumulate from people who could recall their previous lives and recall them in such detail, there's no other explanation. And as a physicist, I was always taught Occam's razor, where just the most obvious explanation was most likely to be the accurate one. And that you could only dispense with the obvious reason why people could recall these things and why they could have these abilities, which they were never taught, The obvious one was they were reborn.
Yeah.
And that to actually explain those phenomena, please supply a better answer, a better solution to that problem, and people who can recall previous lives.
Mm.
And of course they can't.
Yeah,
they can't give a better explanation.
They get more complicated.
Yes.
And more mystical.
Yes. And so Occam's razor just wins.
Yeah. So when you were at university, were these things going around in your head and you were interested in these things as you were studying theoretical physics?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah. And it's also to understand that the primacy of the mind in theoretical physics. They had something called the Schrodinger's equation, which was a fundamental part of quantum mechanics, where that reality required an observer, an event of a human intelligence. Artificial intelligence didn't cut it. It had to be real intelligence before the world as we know it would exist. And they had, obviously, phenomena was known as Schrodinger's cat experiment, which, if you understand quantum physics, you know, it starts to bend your mind, but it's true. Because what was happening that Schrodinger imagined, he never did it, putting a cat inside a box, sealing it. There was a cyanide capsule inside the box attached to a quantum, randomness generator, the decay of a cesium atom, and had a 50-50 chance of breaking the cyanide capsule and killing the cat after a certain time, say 5 minutes. And the question was, after 5 minutes, there's a 50-50 chance of the cesium atom decaying, the cyanide capsule breaking, and the cat dying. So after 5 minutes, was the cat alive or dead? And the answer was, it was neither. In the third state.
Yeah.
And just, how can that be? How can that happen?
Curve time, maybe.
Yeah, whatever it was, but it was actually, that's the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
And now those quantum effects are being used to create quantum computing, random number generators, and so much more.
So you were learning this
stuff
at university?
At university.
Were you studying Buddhism as well? Did you have a Buddhist teacher? Were you meditating?
I was meditating, had a Buddhist teacher.
Yeah.
And I even still remember just when we're talking about fundamental particle physics and the Murray-Gell-Mann quarks and the lecturer flashing on the screen the Buddhist Eightfold Path, because there are three types of quarks come in eight forms, eight combinations.
Yeah.
So even there, he saw the Buddhist Eightfold Path.
Within the quarks, the eight types of quarks.
Yes, in the lecture on quarks.
Yeah.
So all this stuff, what it was doing was expanding your understanding of nature. So what it meant was, just like in Buddhism, through meditation, it's not only the limitations of our concepts block out some of these ideas, like rebirth, like different realms of existence, and just like bliss. When you leave some of this world.
So a big theme here is that, there's this blocking of...
Yeah.
Blocking that by nature, the way we experience the world blocks important parts of that.
Indeed, which is why any spiritual search, any even scientific search, need a lot of courage.
Yeah.
And on the walls of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, which was the science laboratory, though some graffiti which was written on there, which I will always recall, was the eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. So even a scientist has to be rebellious.
Yeah.
Has to be willing to stand up to those in power who propound the status quo, to push knowledge further. In the same way, as you know, that I had to stand up to the status quo to push the equity of females in the Theravada Buddhist tradition.
Yeah.
So there was something very similar there. Even the Buddha was a rebel.
Yes.
as most teachers are, rebels. In other words, they're not going to go on the usual paths expected of them. But the search for truth, for meaning, takes much sacrifice. Mm. And you're willing to make those sacrifices because truth, integrity, overpowers anything to do with the sense of self and being hurt or offended.
And that's where it's why someone can be so confident in their courage.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in a way, these people are pointing out something that other people don't want to see.
Exactly, which is blocked because it's too confronting to see these things. An inconvenient truth, if
inconvenient
you like.
Inconvenient truth, yes. But a truth nonetheless.
A truth nonetheless, which you cannot ignore, and ignorance has a lot of consequences.
Yeah.
It's ignorance, as you know in Buddhism, is a root cause of suffering.
Yeah.
So it may be comfortable for a while just being in ignorance of this lump in your breast, which is a growing tumor.
Yeah.
But if you don't act on it quickly, it's going to cause much more suffering.
The consequences of ignorance. The
consequences of ignorance is increased suffering for you and many other people. So it may be difficult for you to face that truth, but let's face it.
The point you made there is your ignorance also can harm others.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
What a wonderful thing it would be if we all knew that we'd be reborn.
So you're at Cambridge University. You're studying theoretical physics.
Yeah.
And you're also interested in this. It's also leading you and parallel to your interest in the mind
exactly.
And rebirth. And so then you make this jump, and eventually you end up going to a monastery and becoming a monk. Monk, can you fill in how that came about? Because that's a serious decision to make.
It's not a jump.
Not a jump.
It was a seamless transition.
Wow.
To actually to find the truth of the world, not in the laboratory with expensive equipment, but in the jungles of Thailand, just looking into your own mind. That was my experiment.
How did you choose that jungle laboratory versus others? There could have been other Buddhist places or other religions you could have went in search on. Why that jungle?
First of all, the Buddhism was far more rational than other traditions, and asking me to believe in a creator God never made any sense at all. That was just impossible for me to accept. And even my father, he died when I was only 16. He was in the Second World War, and whenever I asked him about religion, he said he'd seen so much suffering during a war. So many people were just blown to smithereens, with nothing left of them. Every night, like imagine a 9/11 in so many cities, every night for a year or two. And there was such devastation. And he said he cannot ever accept a compassionate being created all of this. Mm. That was his choice. Very simple argument, but very powerful.
It's interesting that the First Noble Truth,
yes,
the truth of suffering, is what undermines a created God for so many
yes,
people,
yes.
Right?
Indeed. Mm. You know, even St. Augustine, he was one of the early church fathers. He said you cannot accept a compassionate and all-powerful God.
He made that argument.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because if he's all-powerful, he would do something about this.
Yeah.
If he was all-kind, obviously he can't be all-powerful, because he's negligent.
Yeah.
If you're the boss of drug company, and you had the power, and you knew that these opioids were causing huge problems, you did nothing about it. If you said you didn't have the power, fine.
Yeah.
If you said you didn't have the knowledge, okay. But you have the knowledge, you have the power, and you didn't do anything about it, that's culpable.
That's culpable. And here's the thing, like the retort to this sort of argument is, well, God gave you free will, right?
Uh-huh.
And so this often, you know, when I was young, those Christians would knock on my door and say, come in, tell me. So then I'll ask them these questions.
Yeah.
And then their response to me when I would bring up an argument like an omnipotent but compassionate God doesn't equal suffering, their response is often, well, he gave you free will as well. And so my young response to them was, but okay, but he made the place. So you offer me a whole heap of cupcakes, but you poison a few and give me free will?
Yeah.
It doesn't sort of make sense.
Yeah. The person, just like the drug company.
Yeah.
You had a free will. You didn't need to take those drugs.
Exactly.
Well, I told you they were going to kill you, but you took them anyway. That's your fault.
Yeah.
It's actually passing the buck, passing the blame.
Okay, so then, but
it's,
so
it's victim blaming.
Yeah, victim blaming. Yes, we don't like that.
Yeah, no.
So then this is the answer to why not a Christian religion. But what about the Thai forest tradition? That was a particular tradition you chose, right?
Well, it's because it was focused on meditation more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And it was meditation which really pushed me into becoming a monk.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason was that I was just a normal young man, had girlfriends, and it happened that I was having a long relationship with a girlfriend, and just after, you know, staying with her a little while, there was a meditation retreat going on, so I joined up that meditation retreat, and after 3 or 4 days, I managed to strike it lucky and get into a very deep meditation,
mm-hmm.
and it was far better pleasure than having good sex with your girlfriend.
Yeah.
And was just, that blew my mind that such a pleasure could exist.
Yeah.
And no one had ever told me about it. And so that made me very interested in actually seeking out the pleasure and the power of the mind.
Mm.
So then I went to various teachers to try and find a teacher who could teach meditation and deeply. And this other thing which I remembered, that I had enough of theory. You wanted to have some practice, and I also knew that once you get some deep meditation, you get very happy and joyful.
Yeah.
So I went around to all the different teachers I could find, and to find out who was the happiest.
Yeah.
Which teacher smiled the most.
Yeah.
And I must admit it was a close decision between the Thai forest tradition and the Tibetans,
yeah.
but the Thais won. Yeah.
Wow. So you had this experience on a retreat.
Yeah.
But and it was a deep, blissful experience beyond anything you'd experienced in the world, sex, whatever.
Yes.
This was another level.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, what is that?
Exactly.
But what meditation were you doing that got you there?
It was just a breath meditation.
Breath meditation.
Yeah.
And so then you thought that, but then you still, you didn't stick with that teacher or that tradition.
No, because it needed some deeper foundations.
Yeah.
And especially just when you strike it lucky, then you want to go back and give it a solid foundation rather than something which was hit and miss.
You don't want to leave this to chance.
Exactly, yeah.
And so then you went on search, and your criteria was, if whoever's hitting these states are going to be blissful and happy.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm searching for in a teacher.
Yes.
And then you were the Tibetans and the Thai forest tradition and Ajahn Chah in particular, I say. Yeah.
And Ajahn Chah especially, that, you know, some of the things which he did, which is inexplicable.
Like what?
Like when I first went to see him, I thought he was crazy. He wasn't just a true practitioner. Wow. I say this because he was trying to convince me all sorts of different ways. But then on one occasion, that another monk was having an interview with him, asking some questions. And I was in earshot, just listening to the questions in English. They were translated to him, translated back, and listened to the answers. And then it was weird that the questions which he was answering were my questions, which I was thinking.
Wow.
And I thought of another question, and he answered it. Even though this other monk was asking these questions. And afterwards, this monk, he was actually from L.A., Gary, his name was. And I asked him, the answer to your questions, which Ajahn Chah gave you, what do you make of them? He said, it was rubbish. It made no sense at all. And he wasn't answering my questions at all.
He was ignoring my questions.
Yeah, but he was answering my questions.
Yeah.
Every question I thought, Ajahn Chah would answer it accurately and deeply.
So it was very apparent to you that he was reading your mind.
Yeah.
And you were actually conducting an experiment.
Exactly.
Because you were like, so I'm going to ask this now.
Yeah, and see if it's a reasonable answer.
Yeah.
And it was. And then afterwards, to check with Gary, he said, well, what do you reckon about his answers to your questions? Made no sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So you knew something was going on there.
No, something was going on. That man could read your mind.
Yeah. Very clearly.
Yeah.
And then you said, I'm going to hang around.
Yes,
it's Ajahn Chah for a little
indeed.
While. Turned out to be 9 years, right?
Just 9 years,
So you were in northern Thailand, is that?
Northeast Thailand,
Northeast Thailand.
In the forest.
And so you packed your bags and headed off
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just told everybody I'd be back in a few months and stayed there for nine years because it was so productive.
Yeah.
It was physically very tough.
Yeah.
But meditation-wise, it's very powerful, very deep. And from that, you got great wisdom.
Great wisdom. The deep meditation and great wisdom, we're going to come back
all to. All come together, yeah.
Yeah.
Because even on one occasion that he was, this is when we were starting this monastery in Northeast Thailand, Wat Nanachat. I was one of the first six to go there to start it. And for some reason, Ajahn Chah would come every evening from the main monastery, because it's only about 6 kilometers away, to help support the six Western monks who first started it. I would start about 6 p.m., meditate for a couple of hours, and then do some chanting and a bit of a talk. And the problem was, between 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. was when the mosquitoes came out to take their dinner. And imagine just all these Western monks. This was the first time in that part of Thailand that these mosquitoes ever ate Western food. Not only that, but because you had a bald head and a bare shoulder, that there's more seats at the dinner table.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we got eaten to bits. And together with another young monk, who was actually from Pasadena in L.A., that we would count the mosquitoes on our arm just as something to do to try and avoid the irritation. We got about 60 or 70 at one time.
At one time, 60 or 70?
Yeah.
Wow.
No exaggeration.
But you came here for bliss, remember?
Indeed. So what happened? Thank you to those mosquitoes. Because I had a choice.
Yeah.
And the choice was, you couldn't swap them because your teacher was right, you know, in eyesight. So all you could do is just really do your meditation to really let go.
Let go.
And go deep inside.
Mm.
To where you couldn't feel the body. And that was an amazing thing to be able to do. That when you couldn't feel your body at all, because you were deep inside the mind, that 2 hours passed by really quickly and you're just enjoying yourself immensely. Couldn't feel the mosquitoes biting your arm. And when you came out afterwards, that there was usually the little welts, the bumps in your skin. They weren't there at all.
Mm.
And I thought, first of all, this must be some sort of other psychic power, deep meditation. You don't get bitten by mosquitoes. Later on, I discovered a scientific, rational explanation to this. The mosquitoes are attracted mostly to the carbon dioxide coming out of your pores.
Yeah.
The more you worry about them, the more you're anxious about getting bitten and getting malaria or dengue or something, the more you metabolize, the more carbon dioxide you emit, the more the mosquitoes know you're there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the worry which causes more bites.
Yeah.
And so because your metabolism went way down, you were hardly emitting any carbon dioxide at all, mosquitoes couldn't find you.
No dinner's on.
No dinner's on. Well, they didn't know you were there.
Yeah.
You vanished.
It's like disappearing through the mind and then through the body for the mosquitoes.
So they could see you.
So this is an interesting way of discovering profound meditation states, right? So you were there and you're like thinking, okay, I've got 2 hours here.
Yeah.
I'm either going to sit here with 2 hours and get eaten alive.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to disappear.
Yeah.
I'm going to go deep and disappear.
Yeah.
And then you went deep and disappeared. And so this was like
you had to.
You had to. You had no choice.
Yeah.
And so how did you know how to disappear?
Now that was an interesting question because maybe what I had practiced before, just as a lay Buddhist, knowing how to disappear. And basically it's just when you are still, things vanish.
Yeah.
If you close your eyelids, after a short while, you can't see anything. If this ambient sound doesn't change, then you can't hear anything. Things which stay the same disappear. It's like your body, like a computer. You know, if you don't press a mouse or click something, the screensaver comes on and then it just goes blank.
Yeah.
And that's pretty close to how the brain works and the mind works. It only notices things which change, which are anicca, which are impermanent, which come and go. Something which is always in the background you don't notice. Just like, you know, the smell of the air. The hum, you know, of the air, it's always there. So you can't even notice it unless it disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the same with the art of disappearing. Through stillness, things vanish.
Through stillness, things vanish.
Yeah.
You also mentioned letting go.
Yes, that's what you call stillness.
So stillness and letting go and stillness, what's the relationship there?
Yes, it's letting go is the cause of stillness.
Yeah, okay.
Because when you let go of worrying, doing, being anxious, holding on to stuff, when you let it go, you are not causing the agitation. What Ajahn Chah used to say those first years, he would get his hand up and he'd wave it backwards and forwards. Mm. This is a leaf on a tree. It only moves because of the wind. Mm. If you'd stop the wind moving, then the leaf would eventually become perfectly still. Because mm-hmm. that's its default state. That's a natural state of a leaf. It's not to move. It only moves because something outside of it is causing it to move. The wind. With the human mind, what causes it to move is wanting something. Wanting to get rid of things, wanting to get things, wanting to attain things. When you let go, you're letting go of wanting. Letting it be.
Yeah.
And after a while, things get so still, they vanish.
So there's the letting go, there's no more wind, there's stillness, then the leaf vanishes.
Yeah. So the movement vanishes.
The movement vanishes.
Yeah, and then interesting things happen.
Okay.
Through stillness.
Through stillness.
That much of the energy which we waste by thinking and doing stuff and by fighting the world and fighting reality, well, that energy is stopped, paused, and goes into the mindfulness. Your mindfulness wakes up. The word for enlightenment, Buddha, comes from the word bujati, to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So literally you are waking up. Your mindfulness is getting very, very strong. And that's the fun part, to empower mindfulness. I have this conference about mindfulness, which is such an overused word.
Yeah.
But we have power mindfulness, superpower mindfulness. Mm. It's not just being mindful, it's through stillness. Yeah. Your mindfulness goes into huge, strong levels. And when you're fully charged, not only can you see very deeply, and you're strong enough not to bend the truth to fit what you'd like to hear or what you'd like to see, you're very strong, powerful, your hindrances have been suppressed, and then you can really see amazing things.
So this disappearing is not like a falling asleep.
Oh,
it's a disappearing and waking up.
It's a disappearing
with power.
When past and future disappear.
Yeah.
Your body disappears, your five senses disappear, and that leaves your sixth sense, the mind, to get very, very strong.
Mm.
And of course that goes back to, you know, the science, the nature of the mind. Does it exist or is it just a byproduct of something else? And there you're face to face with this powerful mind because everything else has vanished. You can't see anything, you can't feel the mosquitoes biting you if they're biting you at all, you can't hear anything. And you're deep inside. Powerful, really alive, more alert than you've ever been before, blissed out. That's a very powerful state.
Yeah.
And when you come out afterwards, you're flying.
You're flying.
Words,
yeah,
huge
yeah,
energy.
Yeah.
And it means that when you test that out, you know, when somebody comes along and say some of, or should I say these things, giving all my tricks away.
Yeah, give us the
tricks. Someone says, oh, they've just got into these deep meditations.
Yeah.
I look at you, no way. No, people who follow Tibetan, Buddhism can't get into these deep meditations.
Yeah. You say that?
I say that. And I look at you and see, have I offended you? Of course they can.
Yeah.
But I see that as a little trick
to
see if I've really upset you.
Yeah.
And if
how did I do?
Yeah, you did okay. So if you just, okay, yeah, fair enough. I said, okay, that could have been a deep state. Well done.
Yeah.
Because after deep states of meditation, you can't get angry.
Yeah.
You can't get any ill will. Or you can't get offended.
For a certain amount of time. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there's this idea that, we'll throw it back to you. There's the idea that this is just the suppression of these afflictions and not doesn't get rid of them. And that this is shamatanta, not vipassana, and this sort of weird thing. But actually, if this is the union of shamatanta and vipassana in a way, because
absolutely,
because through this, as soon as you've withdrawn from the five senses and you're in this sixth consciousness, your awareness is I guess you say that after the fact you look back at that and you look at the inside. Is that maybe you could talk
to
that?
Exactly, yes. It's just like I was trained as in science.
Mm.
You have to gather your data, first of all.
Mm.
And unless you've got all your data recorded, you don't try and make assumptions when you've only got half the data from the experiment. Otherwise, you will just make up your assumptions and you'll dismiss some of the data as being anomalies.
Yeah.
There must have been some mistake because it doesn't fit in.
Or you deny it.
Deny, exactly, yes. So that you gather all the data, first of all, of you know, what's it like to have a mind which is freed from the other five senses. And once you have that data, you've got something to work on. And this is weird data, strange data, just like the data you get in these amazing experiments, which sometimes cost a huge amount of money. But this is the data you can get for free. And once you have that data, now you have a mind which has suppressed the five hindrances. You can actually see what's really, really there without distorting the data. And you get incredible insights from that.
And you cannot get these insights without those deep states?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. That's why these jhanas are necessary for enlightenment. And the simile which I often give, it's the best one I've come up with the tadpole and the frog.
Okay.
So once upon a time, there's a little tadpole who lived in the lake and learned everything about chemistry, especially majored in the nature of water. But how could a tadpole know the nature of water? It doesn't know the nature of water no more than a fish knows the nature of water, because a fish has lived all their life in the water. But then one day, a little tadpole is different from a fish because little tadpole grows arms and legs, is changing into a frog. And one day, the frog jumps out of the lake, and this is a totally different experience than it's ever had before. It's weird, it's strange. Something which has always been there, which you could not notice, is missing. Water. Only now can the frog really understand what is the nature of water. In the same way, if you've been living in a world of the five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and you never experience jumping up onto that different land, just mind, deep, blissful, totally different, how can you ever know what these five senses are? Sometimes we say the five senses and this body is a prison. I can prove very clearly to you that the body is a prison. You know why? Because your body is made of cells. That's why it's a prison.
It's made of cells. Different types of bodies, right?
Sometimes when you get so deep, some people turn off and to crack a joke. Just makes people see a little bit deeper.
Yeah. You know, this use of humor, you use humor a lot.
Yes.
And that's like a lightness of mind as well. It's almost a letting go as well.
It's a lightness of mind. It's a letting go. It's a teaching tool.
Mm.
Because sometimes people start to fall asleep. They start looking at their messages because they think this is boring. But you tell a funny story, then people wake up. And you've got their attention for another sort of 10 or 15 minutes. When they get bored again, you can crack another joke.
Yeah.
And I must admit, to give credit where credit's due, I got that from a Tibetan monk who said when he tells a joke, only then the people's mouths are open so he can put in the fill of Dhamma.
Good. That's a skillful means.
Skillful means, yeah.
And so then you were asked to teach, actually. So you did your 9 years with Ajahn Chah.
Yeah.
And I guess you were just familiarizing yourself with these deeper states of meditation.
Teaching is just part of learning, as we all know. The best way to learn is actually to teach somebody.
Yeah.
And then they challenge you and you find out your weak points and you go back and study some more. So that was actually part of our training from Ajahn Chah, to teach, to give, but without judging, your performance.
Yeah.
So you don't give a talk and then think, oh, that was a terrible talk and get depressed. You don't think it's a great talk. One of the teachings which he gave me is, if I give a really bad talk, if at this conference coming up I really just stuff up and say something nasty or wrong by mistake or whatever, and then I never get invited again, yay, now I can become a hermit and
now
relax
you're free.
And free. If I give a really good presentation, a great talk, yay, I've helped spread the Dhamma. So it's a win-win both ways. So they don't care whether it's a good talk or a bad talk. That's somebody else's problem.
Ajahn Chah said this? Or is it your thing?
Yeah, sort of. Sort of my thing, but also his thing as well.
So then it was part of your training to teach.
Yeah.
And he sent you to Australia, right?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
And so then you're teaching people who aren't in the monastery, right? And so one of your things is that you've got to get deep meditation to get insight. So then it's no problem living a lay life and being able to access these jhanic states.
Yeah, that's a problem.
It is a problem. Okay. Yeah. So
because sometimes, something which the Buddha said is that when you have more renunciation, stronger precepts, it empowers meditation.
Yeah.
So these meditations are like born of letting go, renouncing. And that's very difficult, you know, when you have your family, your kids, the wife, money worries. And so there is much more to think about as a layperson, basically. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I've spent a lot of time building monasteries for monks and nuns to give more opportunity. It's why the Buddha established the Sangha, the renunciants.
Yeah.
The renunciants, the letting go.
Yeah.
So why not?
Yeah. So in your monasteries, you can have a little sign that says, this is the place of letting go.
Yeah.
And people can come and let go.
Yeah, they can let go. That's why even in monastery, we don't have donation boxes anymore.
Wait, what do you have?
Letting go boxes.
Letting go boxes. That's great. Let go here.
Yes, I am.
generosity. Practice generosity and letting go.
That's exactly, yes.
So there's this simplified life.
Yeah.
There's this deep practice where you are sort of leaving the five senses behind.
Yes.
And then you go into a deep state of jhana, which starts off with the sixth consciousness, or it's an experience of sixth consciousness.
Yes, yeah.
So you're this frog out of the water for the first time, right?
Yes.
And with that, you learn both about the water.
Yeah.
But you must also learn about, are you learning about the oxygen as well, the sixth consciousness as well?
Oh, because afterwards, that's only the first wake you jump out of.
Yeah, okay.
And then you jump out of this lake called the will.
The lake of will.
Yes, in other words, your will stops.
The will stops. Okay.
So choosing, doing stuff. Now, for many people, that's very challenging.
It might be scary for some people.
Really scary, deeply.
Yeah.
Because even I've seen already on the streets, July the 4th, Independence Day, the land of the free. Free from what?
Yeah, not free from letting go, I don't think.
There's two types of freedom.
Yeah.
There's a freedom of desire, so you can go and do whatever you want, whenever you want to do it. Yeah. You have the means, the wherewithal, the rights, the power, the money, to go and do whatever you want to do, eat whatever you want. But there's also the second type of freedom, which is a freedom from desire.
Yeah.
Where you don't need anything. You don't want anything. Where the will stops. And for many people, that's almost like giving up their most prized possession. But when you do give up that prized possession of the will, you can't move. Now you really start pissing out big time.
Yeah, that's another level?
Another level. That's the second jhana.
Second jhana.
Yeah, that's where the will stops. You can't make any choice. That's why it lasts a long time, because you can't decide to stay in, to go out anywhere.
Yeah.
But that thing which you thought was an essential part of your being, the will, is disappeared.
Yeah.
And of course that's scary, because you've never been that before and you feel you're going to be very, 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 very dangerous. But just to make this an interesting video, there was one friend who follows this type of meditation, has a group over in Colombo, I won't say who it is, but one of his disciple, is a very skilled meditator. So, and the leader of this group is a doctor. And so this doctor, when his friend was in a deep meditation, got out his scalpel, you know, he disinfected the area and cut into his skin. He couldn't cut. The scalpel couldn't penetrate the skin. Mm. But this person was in a jhana. He couldn't go in. So, you know, he put everything away, he was filming everything. And then afterwards, the next time they were meditating, he asked permission this time. He said, next time you're in a deep meditation, it's okay that I just do an incision on your arm.
Mm.
Without any anesthetic, just disinfecting the area. Mm. He said, yeah, okay. So with permission this time, the doctor just made an incision on the arm, and it was just the scalpel cut through normally.
Mm.
And he sewed it up and just put a bandage on it. No aches or pains or anything. And it was an interesting experiment. That only if you give permission can that scalpel penetrate the skin within this deep meditation.
How do you understand that? Because I understand not feeling it.
Yeah.
But I don't understand the meditation doing something physiological to not being able to cut. How do you understand that?
Well, this is sometimes you see these performances, sometimes they're done in Hindu spiritual rituals.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, people climbing up, ladders of sorts.
Yes.
And nothing cuts them.
Or the classic laying on a bed of nails.
Right? Yeah, but this is even worse because this is really sharp swords.
Oh,
and I remember reading the article, I never saw it myself, where a German tourist, but that's his fake.
Yeah.
So he decided to climb up this ladder of swords and was in hospital. I don't know how many stitches he had in his hands and legs and something. It was real. So how that works, you're not really sure.
Yeah.
But it does work. And that's why that even in the time of the Buddha, there's one of the suttas, there was this one monk who was sitting in the middle of the forest, and two villagers who were searching for mushrooms or whatever, herbs in the forest, saw this monk sitting perfectly still and thought he was dead. And being devout Buddhists, they thought, we can't just leave this monk to get eaten by jungle animals, so it wouldn't take them that long to carry some wood.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave him enough wood to have a funeral pyre, put the monk on top, lit it, did whatever chanting they knew, and then they were busy people, you know, life, you can't hang around cremations of you or for many hours. They went off and continued their job of searching for mushrooms or something. You know, the fire was already established, that would do the rest of the job. And they were very impressed the next morning when that monk came into the village on arms round. Not even his robes were charred.
Really?
Yeah.
Like a Khaleesi.
Yeah. And that was, you know, in the suttas, in the time.
That's
of
in the suttas, yeah. So this is an amazing thing that happened with deep states of meditation.
Yeah.
Physiological things as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's more amazing is the disappearance of will.
Yeah.
Like that's profound, right?
That's profound. But what is the nature of will? You ask any neuroscientist, and they say that it's just, it doesn't come from you.
Yeah.
You ask anybody in the advertising, they control your
will. They control your will, yeah.
Yeah. And we never think we're being controlled.
Yeah.
You ask anyone in government.
Yeah. Free will is an illusion.
Exactly. It's control.
Yeah.
They make you vote the way they want you to vote.
Through algorithms.
Algorithms through fear. There's so many different ways of getting a person to be under your control.
You talk about knower and doer.
Yeah.
Right? And that part of what you teach about is moving the mental energy from doer to the knower.
Yeah.
And so the relationship between the doer and will.
Yeah, the doer is the will.
The doer is the will.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, when you're moving this energy from doer to knower, the energy is so much in the knower that the doer is let go.
Yeah.
Is that sort of how
exactly,
it works?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't stay all the time like that because, you know, you've got jobs to do.
Yeah.
But at least you can hang out just with the
knower. We're going to produce some books, your book.
Yeah, yeah. But after a while, that's why every now and again, it's one of the poems, which I've repeated already a couple of times on this trip, from William Blake, who was a 17th century English poet and artist, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. So that always struck me when I first read that as a student. So that was something which was powerfully a sign that the person had been very still. They could see so deeply and experience so deeply.
Yeah.
And that is the case, that when you do create so much stillness in your mind, you're so happy, so powerful, so joyful. And it also means that's where you find out the nature of beauty. As the next story coming up, it's one of my grossest, but it was so amazing and so true. It makes a strong point to people who are so dulled out by our modern world, that on a retreat, which I was teaching, I was always meditating as well, and he had to go to the toilet like everybody else, and after sitting down, just doing what we call a number two, defecating, I just happened to look in the bowl afterwards. Wow!
Glistening.
Beautiful. Fragrant. Now, this is not...
Fragrant,
yeah. Getting into the smell, the aroma. Look, most fragrances these days are so plastic, so chemical.
Yeah.
This is as natural, as raw, as earthy as you can possibly get.
Yeah.
It was real. Like other fragrances, you know, aren't real.
Yeah.
And then... It was beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's afterwards, which really shocked me. And one of my friends who works in CERN, the fundamental particle accelerator underneath the mountains of northern Italy, France, and Switzerland, he was saying that was a really important story for him.
Mm.
The nature of beauty.
The nature of beauty, yeah.
Yeah, if you can see a piece of your own shit, yeah. It's really beautiful.
You need to write a book on aesthetics.
Yeah. But if you can do that and it's real, then what is beauty anyway?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's what your mind adds onto this world.
Mm-hmm. It's this constructive part of the experience that we're talking about.
Yeah. So it's not out there.
Yeah.
You make it beautiful.
Yeah.
Just by your perception.
And then being in deep meditation, as you come out, and that sort of experience permeates... You know, the post-meditation experience.
Yeah, you blissed out.
You blissed out, so everything becomes part of that bliss.
Yeah, because so beautiful, so wonderful.
Well, I think we might sort of finish up on this idea. A lot of the criticism people give to meditators, right?
Yeah.
People who go into these deep states and that they're not out in the world helping the world. Now, I don't think anyone can lay that crime at your feet because you're certainly out in the world and doing good deeds such as, making sure that Bhukshinis can get ordained. Yeah. How do you respond to that? It seems like it's a false dilemma they're putting people in.
Not as this is where you get your energy from.
Yeah.
And this is your base. Like, you have a family, a home. After a hard day's work, you can go back to that home. And just relax.
Mm.
You don't have to. Hopefully, you don't have to fight. This is another place where
where
you find love, and you can give love. A place of rest, your home.
Yeah.
And so this is the home of a good monk or a good nun in his deep meditations. So no matter what other people can throw at you, what they want to do to you, you've got this beautiful place where not even the mosquitoes can find you. So it's your source of energy and stability, your home.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. It's hard to do good work when you're homeless, right?
So
if you don't have this mental space of home, how are you going to be in the world and do good work? And it's to contrast that with a lot of people nowadays are thinking you need to be angry to do good work in activism. So this is quite the opposite to that. Sort of, you can have the energy that comes from this deep space of meditation that will carry you through to do the good work.
And indeed, sometimes when even on a smaller scale, that your wife gets angry at you because you spent too much time sort of talking with monks instead of doing shopping or whatever, then if she starts shouting at you, all you hear is her anger.
Yeah.
You don't hear the why she's angry.
Mm.
You know, you have countries who get angry, United States, And you're not listening to the reason why they're getting angry. It's just, you know, that, you know, you're demented, you're, you know, you're uncivilized. We just hear the anger, we don't hear the why from the anger. And it's also, to understand someone, you have to get close to them. And this is one of the reasons why, when you're angry, you raise your voice. Why do you usually raise your voice? Because someone's a long distance away. So getting angry, raising your voice, physically shows you're distant. It emotionally also says you're not connecting. You're a long way from one another. But when we're close together, physically, you don't have to raise your voice. And emotionally, if you're close together, listening and harmonizing and having kindness towards one another, also you don't need to raise your voice. Anger is a sign of emotional distance. And you can never connect with a person and understand them and get them to understand you when you're so far apart with anger.
Very nice. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
Another day.
A little bit of time.
Another time.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the Wisdom Podcast. That was fantastic.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Next on the Wisdom Podcast, I speak with Robert Thurman, pioneering scholar and translator in the Tibetan Buddhist world and professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist studies at Columbia University.
But then you realize you're responsible for shaping your world and shaping your experience. And you sort of can, you can reduce it to a open canvas. You know, the realization of emptiness is like reducing it to an open canvas. If you get stuck on the open canvas being blank, then you can't do creation stage either. If you mistakenly think emptiness is something you can take a hold of and it's an objective thing out there. But if you realize emptiness is the nature of all the relationalities and that therefore you can shape them with mantra, then you enter into creation stage. You realize the universe is a blank in a way. The universe is up for grabs. And you're one of the shaping forces. You're not the only one, but you're one.